Welcome to Wired Foresight. I'm Greg Williams. From the moment we wake up and check our phones to when we're listening to our smart speakers or online, our data is being constantly captured by organisations that are part of a hyper-connected data economy. In today's session, we'll explore how, in an era of accelerating technological change, we can reclaim our privacy and ensure that data brokers, tech giants and governments collect and use data in ways that consumers approve of and are transparent. Our guest today is Carissa Vies. Carissa is an associate professor in philosophy at the Institute for Ethics in AI and a fellow at Hertford College at the University of Oxford. She works on privacy, technology, moral and political philosophy, and public policy. She's also the author of the recently published book, Privacy is Power. Carissa, welcome. Great to have you with us today.
Thank you, Greg. It's great to be here. I'm a huge fan of Wired.
Great. Thank you so much. So, as I said, the title of your book, Privacy is Power. And I think the subtitle is really notable. Why and how you should take back control of your data. And I think what's really powerful about your book is that you don't just outline many of the challenges around data privacy. You also offer some really practical steps for how we can all start thinking about the data economy and ways of protecting individual freedoms and liberal democracy as a whole. So maybe you could address the first part of that and explain why you chose to write the book and why does this matter?
I've been researching privacy for quite a while now, about 6 or 7 years, and I was extremely unsatisfied with the kind of books I was reading. Many of them were very good, but were only about one aspect. Most of them were very theoretical or very technical. And the more I read about the topic, the more I grew alarmed at the state of the situation. What we're doing is really unwise, to put it very mildly. And I thought the time was perfect for writing a book that was extremely accessible to anyone, even if you've never heard anything about privacy or tech, but also to experts who might have not thought about the philosophical underpinnings of privacy. So there are many experts on privacy who work on the law or who work on computer science. And I wanted to write a book about that explained the big picture of privacy. Why is it important not only for individuals, but also for society? And I also wanted it to be very practical. In academia, our job is kind of to criticize what's going on. So it's very easy to just say the negative, you know, what's wrong with this view and what's wrong with the other. And it's not that common to propose something. But here we face a practical problem. We have a huge problem in our hands right now. We need to solve it now before it's too late. And somebody needs to propose something. So I wanted a book that was also useful for policymakers, but also for individuals, in that I try to suggest what you can do as a citizen and as part of somebody in a community to help protect privacy.
Yeah, and I think the urgency really comes through very, very well in the book, the fact that we need to act now as this is an ongoing situation that is obviously only going to accelerate as we move forward into this data economy. So I think that most Wired readers are going to be aware of the way in which our data is being tracked online by search engines or social networks in any website we visit whatsoever. I'd like to get your sense of, are there more insidious ways that this is happening that people are largely unaware of?
Yes, there are. And it's happened to me even like in workshops with very, very expert people in the room, that even experts forget about these things because data is very abstract. Yes, you know your data is being collected, but what does that mean? So I'll give you like a couple of examples of really surprising things that happen in the way our data is collected, but also a couple of examples of how that translates in your life. So a couple of examples is, for instance, if you have a smart car and when you get in the car, not only is your location being tracked, which, you know, maybe you can imagine, but also how fast or slow do you drive, and very surprising things like the kind of music you hear. And for instance, bankers are buying that information off of Spotify to try to figure out whether, I don't know, maybe you might be depressed and that might influence whether you can pay back a loan. And even your seat tracks your weight, and that could get sold to, for instance, insurance companies. And another example is the use of audio beacons. So companies want to know who you are and that you own a particular laptop and a particular phone and that you live somewhere. So say you wake up in the morning and you're listening to ads on the radio. Those ads have audio beacons that your phone picks up. So say you listen about, I don't know, some wonderful pairs of shoes on the radio or whatever it is, and then you look them up on your laptop and you find the nearest store to your house, and then you visit the store. Through these audio beacons that will also be broadcasted in the store, the company can know that you heard that radio ad in the morning, you looked it up on your laptop, and then you went to your local store to kind of figure who you are. And there are many other examples about how our data gets collected in very invasive ways and very invisible ways. And what does that mean? It means that companies know things like who your friends and family are, what are your sexual practices and tendencies, what are your political leanings, whether you drink and how much you drink, how much you eat, how much you weigh, with whom you sleep, whether you're having an affair, and really sensitive things that get used against you in all sorts of decisions, whether you get a loan, an apartment, a job. And this is all underground. So you never get to see what happens. You never get to object to it. You never get to correct data that might be wrong. You never get any kind of report about it.
And you used the example of someone getting in a smart car and that data being used in a certain way. Some people might argue, insurance companies, for instance, that by having access to that data, they could provide superior services to their customers. Do you think there are uses of data that can be, you know, seen as positive and actually giving something back to consumers as well?
Definitely. Probably the best case is medicine. We all want better medicine. And just in order for your doctor to know what's wrong with you, you have to tell them certain kind of personal data. That's a no-brainer. But I think it's very easy when data is not regulated to use it as an excuse to collect all kinds of data and then misuse it. So for instance, in the case of insurance companies, it used to be the case that insurance meant that you pool a group of people, and that's a way of pooling risk. So you have like statistical experts, and you know roughly like X amount of people are going to get sick. So you calculate a prime, and everybody shares that risk. But today, it's more and more the case that individuals have to bear their own risk, such that insurance, I mean, it's not clear that it's insurance anymore. So if you get judged on the basis of, say, your genetics, because a cousin of yours did a genetic test and you don't even know about it, but that's going to make you pay a higher premium, that's not your fault. And in a way, it's kind of undermining this social fabric of trust and cooperation because you're paying your own way.
Yeah, sure. I mean, and I think it'd be good just to sort of step back for a moment. And, you know, we hear this phrase surveillance economy a lot. I mean, it's effectively based primarily on advertising models, right? Do you think that maybe that the key moments was back in, you know, whenever it was, I think the year 2000, when Google launched AdWords and fundamentally kind of realigned itself from its kind of original mission, which was all around the users, to actually aligning itself with advertisers?
I think that's exactly right. That's how it started. And it was very unfortunate because Google knew that this was a conflict of interest. And originally, they hadn't wanted to rely on ads precisely for that reason. And then they couldn't find a different way of funding themselves. And they gave in and essentially betrayed their users because suddenly their loyalty was with the publishers. And even though there was already some kind of data economy back then in the sense that some personal data was exchanged and sold, it had never been used to this scale and never so much data, and it had never been put together quite in the way that Google managed to do it. So it was a game changer, and everybody followed.
And do you think that, you know, it's interesting, some of the examples you've given, it seems to me that, like, yes, there are very precise levels of data that we can get into, and that people who are part of this surveillance economy really do know very intimate details of people's lives. But is it also the case that a lot of this data really is fundamentally pretty low quality data, that major decisions are being made by, you know, whether you can, whatever it is, get a loan, or whether you qualify for something, is being made fundamentally on pretty low quality thresholds?
Yeah, that's true. And there's a very kind of dangerous paradox, because on the one hand, the data is precise enough that it could, for example, be enough to sway an election, because you only need to have a minimal effect when you're dealing with millions of people to do that. But on the other hand, it's not accurate enough to make fair decisions about individuals. And there are at least two reasons for why the data is not accurate enough. One is that companies don't have an incentive to have enough of accurate data. Let's suppose that you're trying to judge whether somebody's a smoker and try to base like a premium, an insurance premium on the basis of that data. And say you have an algorithm that gets it 75% right, 75% of the times right, that's enough for you because that's already cost saving for you as a company. But of course, for the individual, it's very unfair because there will be 25% of people who are not smokers and are being judged as smokers. And we need to change the incentives. The second reason why personal data is very often inaccurate is that personal data expires pretty quickly and there's no system correcting data. So how many times you've liked something on Facebook and then suddenly you don't like it anymore because maybe the politician you liked did something stupid and changed their views, or maybe you were a teenager and you liked bad music and you don't like bad music anymore, but you never go back and click unlike. And you change address, you change jobs. It happens all the time. So that data expires quickly and you're judged on the basis of all data.
So we're seeing kind of obviously increasing, attempt at regulation, both in Washington and in Brussels and here in the UK. I'm interested to get your sense of one of the ones that we're hearing a lot about, which is the changes that Google is making to Chrome. It's ditching third-party cookies. Is that going to make a big difference, do you think?
No, it's not. This is a very controversial move by Google. Many people are criticizing it because essentially Google has figured out a way in which they can get all the data they used to get from cookies in a different way that nobody else can. And essentially the criticism is that they're trying to block other companies from having certain kinds of data. And in that way, kind of make sure that they still have the dominance when it comes to personal data. And even though the methods they're using are more privacy protecting, they're not privacy protecting enough. So right. You could still infer all kinds of sensitive things about people, especially with regards, there are many questions, but with regards to, for instance, websites that use a login attached to Google. So that's very personal. And then you can make inferences regarding the groups that this person is included in. So it doesn't look like it's going to be good news for privacy or for antitrust. And what Google is trying to do is not rethink its business model. It's just saying, okay, how do we rework this into it like looking good, but we still have the same business model that depends on the exploitation of personal data. And that's a mistake.
So I know it's an obvious question and everyone must ask you this. So which search engine do you use, Carissa?
I use DuckDuckGo because it doesn't work like that.
Okay, and there are other search engines are available. So in your book, you write about the role of data brokers, which I think is a really interesting area. Can you just get into that a little bit? Tell us who they are, how they operate.
I call them data vultures because these are companies that want to have a file on every user on the internet, and they collect all the data they can on you. It can include things like your purchasing history, your browsing history, social media data, data about your credit records, your medical records, all kinds of things. And then they sell it essentially to the highest bidder. And in many cases, it's other companies like insurance companies, banks, prospective employers. But in some cases, there have been scandals of them selling it to ex-abusive partners or even fraudsters, which is just unbelievable. These data brokers compile lists about people as well. So not only do they sell individual files, but also lists. And the lists that they compile are incredibly problematic. So they include things like people who have been victims of rape, people who suffer from HIV, people who suffer from impotence, from erectile dysfunction, all these kinds of extremely sensitive categories, people who have lost a child. And it just seems morally repugnant that we allow companies to profit from that kind of knowledge. It just seems extremely problematic. And it's a bit like companies using our vulnerabilities to get to us.
Right.
And that seems something that we shouldn't be allowing. So that's why I argue that we shouldn't allow personal data to be sold and bought, because we incentivize these kind of practices.
We have the Data Protection Act and GDPR. Are they not enough?
They're not. I don't want to kind of badmouth them, because the GDPR, for instance, was an amazing achievement. And at that time, I don't think that we could have come up with something better because of all the pressure that there was and because it was so innovative and so on. But it's obviously not enough. At least two reasons are kind of just blaringly obvious. One is that we get privacy scandals all the time, every week. So clearly, I mean, not enough is happening. And secondly, it's ridiculous that most of the burden is on the shoulders of individuals. I am so annoyed by clicking no to cookies every time. It's just totally inefficient. If And I have to click it because they can't remember it. So every time it's the same. The default should be no data collection. Defaults are really important. And that way, if somebody wants their data collected, then that website is justified in remembering it them, and they don't have to click every time. So at the, if only for those two reasons, no, the GDPR is not enough.
So clearly, you know, the consent that that we're offering around our data, it isn't fit for purpose. This is only, of course, going to become more challenging in the coming years. But one area which we're seeing, you know, normally we use the word surveillance, you know, around the data economy. Clearly, cameras are being embedded into all kinds of objects. We're seeing a creep towards facial recognition in devices from most of the large hardware manufacturers. What do you think needs to happen in order for us to stay in control of that data?
I think it's very hard to stay in control of data. Data flows like water. And so one important thing is to ban trades in personal data, which includes sharing. So sometimes companies don't sell it, but they share it in exchange for other kinds of data, and that amounts to the same thing. I think we also have to ban personalized content and ads. The advantages that they give us are very, very, very small, and the disadvantages are huge. And we have to ban certain kinds of surveillance equipment that are just too dangerous for anonymity. One of the fantastic advancements of the city as a technology, was to allow people anonymity. Before then, you lived in a small village, everybody knew you, and it was impossible to say or do something in an anonymous way. And the city brings this amazing opportunity to walk in a crowd and nobody knows you. And that has been amazing for innovation, for creativity. And if we plague the city with identity or identifying surveillance, cameras, and other detection techniques, we are undermining something that has been a fantastic advancement in society. Also, importantly, the ability to protest anonymously. The moment you have facial recognition, that goes down the drain. And there are very few people who will be brave enough to say, I'm going to protest nonetheless.
I think as sort of the data collection economy has grown over the past few years, I think most people, most individuals now are realizing, you know, that they are the product in the famous line. And I'm just interested to know from your research, like, do you think that awareness is growing among consumers because of the number of bad experiences people are having, whether that's, you know, hacks or online shaming or unwanted targeting? Are we creating an environment, do you think, in which people are relearning almost the value of privacy?
That's exactly right. I think we forgot it for a while. We got convinced by Zuckerberg and others that privacy was something of the past, that we had evolved. And now we realize that privacy is as important or more important than ever, and that we're losing it. So in a recent survey I carried out with my colleague, Sharon Brooke, we discovered that about 92% of people have had some kind of bad privacy experience online. Sometimes it's related to theft of identity, or sometimes it's public humiliation, or even being the target of spyware. And the more we have those experiences, or the more we know people who have had a bad experience, the more we realize how we could get hurt. And very important are collective instances of harm, because very, very importantly, these are mostly invisible. So if you are the victim of an algorithm, most of the times you won't even know about it. So yeah. When a lot of people are, and it gets out into the public, it's really an important opportunity. So two examples are the Cambridge Analytica scandal, in which it was clear that a political firm was trying to undermine democracy. And another example is in the UK with the A-levels, and how young people realized that their future could be compromised by an algorithm that hasn't been validated, that hasn't been subjected to a randomized control trial, and that's scary.
And we've talked a lot about individuals, but clearly there's a big threat to civil society. How do you think about the steps we need to put in place in order to protect, obviously, not just our own privacy, but also the bigger sort of like the bigger picture, so that society is almost kind of private by default, and we can protect sort of some of the institutions that maybe are being eroded by this free flow, this water-like behavior of data, as you describe it?
Yeah, talking about kind of collective, even in the most capitalist societies, we don't allow votes to be sold because that undermines democracy. And for the same reason, we shouldn't allow personal data to be sold. And one of the things that I argue for in my book is that this idea that privacy is individual is very misleading. This idea that, well, you know, It's like, well, you like chocolate, I like vanilla, and it's just a personal preference. And if you're not a criminal, then you have nothing to hide, nothing to fear. It's totally wrong. Privacy is important, first and foremost, because it's a collective concern and a political concern, as the Cambridge Analytica scandal suggests. And one of the things that brings me hope that the data economy can be regulated is that intelligence agencies and governments are realizing how much of a national security issue this data economy is. It's just a ticking bomb to have that kind of personal data out there. And China wants it, and Russia wants it. And we've already had a lot of examples in which there are hacks to even like normal apps, and that they're trying to get to the personal data of people. And just as an example, if hackers were to hack only 10% of the electrical appliances in a country and turn them on at the same time, they could bring down the national grid. And you can imagine, like, just imagine having a pandemic and being cut off from electricity. That would be disastrous. It could bring a country to its knees. And it's not hypothetical. The UK grid has endured attacks during the pandemic. And just like academics have known for decades that a pandemic was coming and that they had warned us and we didn't listen, we know there's going to be a massive cyber attack. And what's the relationship between privacy and cybersecurity? We have built the internet to be insecure so that we can collect personal data.
Yeah.
And that's a ticking bomb. So that gives me hope that governments will be worried enough to change it.
I want to get to some of the questions from people watching this session. But one final question from me, Carissa. You've got a lot of solutions, a lot of really practical steps that we could take in order to protect privacy. What do you think the data economy will look like in maybe, I don't know, 5 years, assuming the changes that you'd like to see are implemented? How do you think it should work?
So I'm, in a sense, I'm really optimistic because I think this state of affairs is totally unsustainable. It's like the Wild West and it's going to come crashing down. I'm hoping that we manage to regulate it before something really bad happens, like a genocide in the West or something like that. So if we implement these changes, on the one hand, things superficially don't look that different. We can have cutting edge tech. We can have appliances and all kinds of things. But underneath it all, it looks like data is not collected by default. You have to sign up, opt in to have your data collected. And even then, there are certain kinds of personal data that you're not allowed to give out because it contains data about others, such as your genetic data. Data is routinely deleted, and all data is all the time being updated. And you get the chance to access all of your data. You get the chance to know where your data is and how it's being used and to correct it whenever there's an inaccuracy. There aren't any data brokers. I don't see how they're good for society at all. And businesses like Facebook and Google, if they want to survive in the long term, they have to change their business model. In the past, we've already banned business models that are just too toxic for society. And I make this analogy about how personal data is as toxic as asbestos. And we need to be very careful with it. It doesn't mean that we can't use it. It means that we need to be extremely careful with it. So this business model of selling personal data disappears.
So Carissa, let's move on to some of the questions that are coming in. I don't know if there's any one that maybe has caught your eye, or I could maybe, there's a couple that I think are quite interesting I might like YouTube. To get your views on. So anything that's catching your eye, or shall I?
You choose.
I think there's an interesting one from an anonymous attendee. It's talking about authoritarian and totalitarian states are obviously interested in collecting personal data beyond their own state borders. Do you think that personal data privacy should become part of almost diplomatic policy of liberal democracies, so that it becomes inbuilt into sort of the way that we interact with other nations, that maybe we need international accords around this?
Absolutely. I love that question. And I'm actually writing about that right now, today. I think it's exactly the right moment to rekindle all the alliances, in particular between the UK, the US, and Europe. But also, there are many other countries trying to regulate big tech, like Australia and Japan, New Zealand. And it's something that we have to work with together, because data isn't something that stays in a country. It just doesn't happen. And we have incredibly important rivals who are extremely good at hacking. So we need to come together and have something like a human rights declaration, but regarding data and AI, because it's just around the corner. It's on us with regards to privacy. And it's something really urgent. And that if we don't do it, our democracies are really in danger.
Another question is really about how consumers, individuals, can try and affect changes in policy. How can we try and change the way that the tech giants collect data about us? What can we do on an individual level?
We actually have a lot of power because all these companies depend on our data. And you'd be surprised how worried they are about your opinion. And so companies like Google and Apple and Microsoft and all of them are monitoring the web to see what people think about these things. And even authoritarian governments, I have really good sources on this, are very worried about people rebelling against the system. So we don't need like 90% of people to do this. We only need 5, 10, 15% of people for things to radically change. So what you can do, there's all kinds of things. But first and foremost, choose a laptop and a phone from a company that doesn't earn their keep primarily through personal data, because they will always have a conflict of interest. Choose privacy-friendly products. So instead of using Google Search, use DuckDuckGo. It's really fantastic. It used to be not that good, but it's getting better and better. And sometimes it's much better than Google Search, actually.
We published a very long feature on it in Wired a year or so ago by Wired's Matt Burgess. And it's definitely an interesting search engine. Sorry, I interrupted you, Chris.
Definitely. Instead of using WhatsApp, use Signal. Instead of using Gmail, use ProtonMail. There are all kinds of alternatives out there. Protect other people's privacy. It's really important. So if you get a message that's funny, but that clearly violates someone's privacy, don't re-forward it. Don't post it online. Don't post pictures of others without asking for their consent. Contact your political representatives. Tell them that you're worried about this topic. Pressure them. Ask them to read books about this, to be well-informed. Ask them about what policies they're implementing. Just do anything you can and know that you'll fail. Protecting privacy is really difficult in the digital age. But even if you fail, you can protect yourself enough that you can save yourself from a case of identity theft, which is already an amazing thing. But also, even if you fail, there's an expressive element that's really important. You are telling companies and businesses and governments that you are not okay with it. And that matters. Because in 2 days' time or 2 months or 2 years, when there's a inquiry and the data protection agencies look into a company, if they find emails of customers like you saying, hey, I'm not accepting your data collection, I want you to send my data, I want you to delete it, that creates a paper trail that is very important.
Chris, there's some really great practical steps there. Thank you. And that actually, I think, answered quite a few of the questions that we didn't have time to answer. Thank you out there for sending in the questions. Some really great ones there. I think that Chris has managed to touch on nearly all the subject matter that you've raised. So thank you, Chris, for your time today, for sharing your insight. If you haven't read Chris's book, Privacy is Power, please do go ahead and order a copy. And if you enjoyed the session, please do check out the rest of the Wired Foresight series, which includes discussions with Ipsos Mori's CEO Ben Page on what life could look like in 2025, Sana Karangagi on the AI roadmap, Shopify's head of EMEA, Shimona Mehta, on the future of retail, all are available at wired.co.uk. A final thank you again to Carissa. Thank you so much to all of you for joining the session. Much appreciated. Thank you. Stay well, and we'll see you soon.
Thank you.
If you're enjoying this series, please do give us a 5-star review wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps us grow the Wired community. Thank you so much.